Hey everyone, Chat Cemetery is back. Today we're talking all about the novel Christine, and Katie Schaefer is joining me to discuss it. This novel came out on April 29th, 1983, so we're making our way through the 80s here, and it feels like a pretty good time to be a Stephen King fan. Wouldn't you agree, Katie?
I definitely agree. There were movies and books and all kinds of things coming out at this time.
It really feels like the 80s is the time period when things really ramped up for Stephen King. And I'm not saying he's necessarily slowed down by any means, nor have the adaptations, as we both well know. But this feels like, okay, he's getting into his cocaine-fueled groove, I guess you could say. And a lot of crazy things are coming out. And with Christine, you have this car who becomes one of the main characters in the book. And I think when he takes certain things like that, you know, when you take a house and make it into a character or a car or something, you know, he does this in a different way because the car literally comes to life. It's not just your everyday average car like you can have in some things and still have it feel like a character. So I think that's something that made this unique. And it was pretty long book. It's not as long as The Stand or anything by any means, but for what it is, it was pretty long. And the first edition hardcover was 526 pages. I believe my paperback copy was a little shorter than that. It was a little over 500.
Yep. I listened to the audiobook for this and it was about 15 hours, which is short for a King book, but not, it's still a hefty listen.
Yeah, I can imagine. And I would venture to say it probably took me close to 15 hours to read the book too. And, you know, that's kind of nice that you have that comparison there. It's like, you know, I put this many pages into it, but you have an exact amount of time that you put into the book. So it's like, yes, I have spent a lot of time with Christine lately.
Yes. Oh gosh. And at times it felt like it was going much slower than 15 hours. So, but we'll get into that, I'm sure.
Yeah, one of the first things I want to discuss, though, are the characters, because you really have a few central characters. You have, obviously, Christine, the car. You have Dennis Gilder and Arnie Cunningham, these two friends who sort of go through this experience together, but in very different ways.
Yeah, exactly. Like, and it's set out in the beginning that they are very different people, and I did enjoy that later on we get some of a different narrator, but most of it is done by Dennis. So everything is kind of coming from Dennis's perspective, but it felt like he was a reliable narrator, which for this kind of story, you need that. But I think, and later on we get Lee, the only woman in the book who gets any kind of real character development, I would say.
Right.
And she's also an interesting thing that he threw into the story that really complicated matters.
I definitely agree. And seeing things from Dennis's perspective, you know, he's a core part of the story, but he's still on the outside looking in. And I think that's part of what makes him that more reliable narrator. If we were getting everything from Arnie's perspective, it would feel like it was very scattershot, probably.
Yes. And the few times we kind of do, it's used really well to illustrate how fractured Arnie is becoming much later on. And that made those rare instances more powerful. So he uses the different narrations very well. And that's kind of how the 80s was for him. You know, with The Stand, we get all of those different narrators. And this was a culmination of that, I think, that showed how skilled he was, even though it still takes him quite a while to get there.
Yeah, you also have LeBay, who ends up playing more of a role than I think we're led to believe at the beginning, because when we find out about Arnie getting the car and then LeBay passing away, it's like, oh, okay, well, maybe that's sort of tied up, but that is not the case whatsoever.
Yeah, and his character, like, that we only got a little bit of his character in the beginning, I was happy about. I was like, oh, good, this is just like a temporary thing and he'll just be weird and gross. But I should have known from the fact that you get that story about him in still fairly early on in the book, probably within the first 150, 200 pages.
Right.
And then it all kind of hides in the background until you really become aware of how involved LeBay is. And the it goes from being, you know, the story of Scary Car to being a story of, like, possession and ghosts and all of that. And I thought that was what I was surprised by, you know, that he was able to weave together these characters in a way that, yes, it's still kind of a haunting story, but it takes it in, you know, takes it in a different direction.
You then have all of these bit characters too. Not necessarily the parents I would put in that category, but the characters like the group of boys who beat up Christine, in a sense. You know, they wail on the car, they defecate on the car. And you have Will Darnell, who is basically this smuggler of sorts. He's, you know, cigarette smuggler, drug runner, whatever you want to refer to him as. And, you know, he's there to basically give Artie this sort of wrench in his plans, because down the line, Arnie gets caught doing these favors for Will Darnell, and it really just sort of puts the heat on him. And without that character, you know, Arnie would probably have a pretty different ending, as would Christine. And, you know, we'll talk about the ending for sure, because I have some thoughts on that. But
yes, I thought the Darnell character was particularly interesting, and the other one, LeBay's brother,
yeah,
who we only get just a little bit of interaction with, but he really sows the seeds that end up leading to the culmination of the story. And even though we only see a little bit of him, he's still a rich character. And, like, you know, through him describing his experiences with his older brother, you know what kind of man he's grown up to be and turned into, and how he's had to lead his life because of these experiences at such a young age. And that was, that story, that part of it, I was just riveted listening to.
I think this book is another good example of King putting a lot of focus on some of the characters who might not mean quite as much to the story as the main characters, but they provide you with these important parts to the point where if you don't have those minor characters in the story doesn't work quite as well. And that's not to say this story doesn't have problems, but typically his character work isn't the root of the problems with these stories.
Right, right. There's other issues that he has, but I agree. His character work, and I think this book, especially after, you know, Cujo was the last one we did, this book in particular really defined a line for me in him going into finessing it, making it skilled and razor sharp at certain points, which he wasn't always the best at. Now he's much better at it. And with this one, those little side characters are done so, so well. And like you said, they add something to the story that the story would be considerably lesser. You could tell it, but it would then just kind of become the story about Evil Car. And Evil Car is not worth 500 pages. Evil Car is like a short on, you know, Creepshow or something like that.
Yeah, maybe a 20, 30 page short story.
Yes, yes, exactly.
On the note of the car, though, what do you think of Christine as a character? Because in some ways, Arnie wouldn't end up being the person he becomes without this car. But we find out it's not solely the car that is responsible. It's Roland LeBay and pretty much everyone the car has ever killed, and it just culminates into this rage that the car has. So I think in a way, you know, the car as a character seems very one-dimensional. You know, it's like rage is the only speed it has.
Yes, that is definitely the case for me as well. It feels like there could be more going on behind it, but we don't get any of that. We, you know, there's just that reference to LeBay being a changeling that we get, that's kind of hinting at what this the source or the reasoning behind this could be. But then that's never really explored in much detail. But Christine feels like just one aspect, like one emotional aspect that he has put, that LeBay has put into this world. And she's the receptacle of all of his rage and anger at everything around him and his entitlement, you know, because all of that rage stems from the entitlement of he's not getting what he wants, regardless of what it is. And it feels like Christine is his weapon, almost his sword with which to strike back, because you can, as is evident in this book, you can really brutally murder somebody with a car.
That's something that's also perfectly normal for us to see in everyday life, whether intentional or not. You know, you always see these car wrecks on the news and you're just like, wow, how did that even happen? Sort of thing. And even though it's something we've seen so many times, it still doesn't cease to amaze a lot of people, which is why every time there's an accident, people are slowing down to look and see what happened.
Right. Right. We call, you know, oh, it's a wreck. Look at that wreck over there. And it's Christine is uses that, ever, like you said, like this everyday way of dying, and makes it very sinister, as opposed to just like, oh, this is a terrible accident. It really makes cars, not really, but it makes them scary, like instruments of death, rather than, oh, this is just how I get around. That's right. How the book kind of gives this fear, it injects this fear into the story, is how everyday and commonplace the weapon is that the bad guy is using to kill people.
This takes it to the extreme, too, because the car does it on its own. There isn't someone at the wheel. The car decides who it's going to go after and when. And we come to realize it's always when Arnie is out of town, so he has an alibi. And, you know, the car fixes itself. And I am going to try to refrain from calling the car her, because as we know, that is something that people feel is a problem in the story. You know, it's like, why are we gendering this car? It is an object.
Right. And what is driving them to do that? You know, it's because it has, it feels like it has a personality. It feels like there, that malevolent rage is a personified thing. And that's what Christine is. And I thought King did that really well. And, you know, when I think about it, I think about it as, oh, well, her, the car. And it points out how easy it is to fall into doing that.
Right.
In such a clever way.
It's funny because people do name their cars. I don't know if this was a thing for you in high school or not, but I had a lot of friends who were giving their cars names. And I had a friend who tried to name my car.
Oh, yes.
I was like, I'm not naming my car. You are not naming my car for me, because I don't want to name my car.
No. It is a car. Yes. Yes. In high school. I do actually have a name for my car, but it's just because it has a Bluetooth in it.
Okay.
So I have to differentiate between all the Bluetooth things. So I was like, okay, well, what am I going to name the car? And I have a white car. And so I named it Cracker, because I thought that was the best name for it possible. Because it is a white mom car and it seemed appropriate. But yeah, naming it, and like, you know, I knew guys especially who were really into their cars and lovingly waxed and washed and take care of vacuum and all of that stuff that is present that Roland LeBay does. And that, you know, it feels normal.
Yeah.
When it's a person doing it. But in this book, it feels weird and icky, you know.
And the car is never renamed. It's not like when someone else gets it, they're just going to name it what they want. The car is always Christine, no matter who is in the car. And that's something that Lee in particular starts to feel. She's like, okay, this car is getting jealous of me, and I keep calling it her, even though I really don't want to. And Dennis feels the same way about just the name of the car in general. And it's like, this car has too much personality for me. It's like, you know, cars will have their quirks, and typically only their drivers will know what those are. It's like, you know, I know at what speed I can hit certain dips in my Jeep without it feeling like we're just all going to fall out of it. So it's one of those things where right. as you get used to the car, you get to know it better. But I would never think that my car has a personality or anything like that. And I think that's another thing that King does well in this. Even if the car still feels one-dimensional, it's sort of just all this rage and hatred coming out of it all the time. And it's like, you know what? If I can't have Arnie to myself, no one can.
Right. And that one-dimensionality makes it all the scarier because there's no, Christine doesn't have any mercy for you. Christine doesn't, you know, want to make a relationship with someone. It's all just rage and there's no escaping and there's no making it better. All you can do is try to destroy it. And as we learn at the end, that's a lot harder said than done.
Absolutely. Another thing I want to touch on is when they sideline Dennis, because I feel like that's when, for me, the story really took a hit. Because obviously with Dennis in the hospital, he's not going to know the details of everything going on outside of his hospital room. He'll only know what people come and tell him. And obviously his parents come visit, Arnie comes to visit, but not as often as you would think given how attached the two of them seem to be before he bought Christine. And even Lee goes to see Dennis more in the hospital, I believe, than Arnie does, because she has, and rightly so, has this concern for Arnie because, you know, without Dennis being there to sort of poke and prod him about certain things and just get in his head and be like, hey, dude, you got some other people to pay attention to, not just your car.
Right. Stop it with the car thing, though.
Yeah, he goes down this darker hole and, you know, Dennis is helpless in that moment just because of this accident, which I'm not entirely sure was an accident.
Right. And it's just so, I felt like there was a lot going on with that and that Dennis being kind of excised from the story for that part. I think King uses it as an opportunity to kind of push the story along because of that limitation of like, well, Dennis isn't around a lot. And if Arnie and Dennis aren't going to be as close as they were, then how is Dennis going to know all this stuff that's going on? But it also kind of feels like, in some ways it's good because it moves the story forward, and in some ways it kind of feels out of nowhere. And Dennis, as the narrator, was kind of the emotional heart of the story, and now things are going forward and it just feels rote. You know, this happened, then this happened, then this happened.
It's almost like there's not a whole lot of feeling behind it, but are we on the same page that the only reason Dennis had his accident was because it was the game Christine was at?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Okay. We are on the same page about that, for sure. Like, it feels, there was lots of rage in the air. And it feels like at times she can affect people. Like, with how insane that guy goes with the car, when those boys go and wreck Christine, like, they go really, really far.
Yeah.
To an insane degree, like pouring sugar in the gas tank and all that crap. Like, it's impressively rageful. And that's kind of, it seems like Christine adds that to every scenario where she's present.
I think with Dennis being sidelined too, you just have this sense that even he knows things are going to get worse. And he can tell that Arnie is hiding a lot when he comes over. I believe it's after Thanksgiving dinner or whatever, and he brings a six pack and stuff like that. And they sort of have this nice moment that reminds Dennis of the time before Christine. But at the same time, he can tell that there's something very different about Arnie and that he's not exactly who he wants Dennis to believe he is still.
Right. He senses that there's a front going on, and that he talks regularly about there being this walled off place that where they had shared everything before, and he could say, you know, be truthful and honest about everything. Now he can't do that anymore. Now there's areas where he dare not go, as it were. And that's, it feels like in that scene, it is that space where he's not allowed to go has grown so much that it feels like there's just this little area where Dennis is allowed and the rest of Arnie is now closed off to him.
it really feels like this story needs Dennis to thrive, because without Dennis, I found myself getting a little more bored with the story. I was like, all right, yeah, Arnie sucks, and we're not really seeing it from Dennis's perspective, except for those moments where we see Dennis, not see, but where we read about Dennis being in the hospital. And then it's like, okay, Dennis is getting all of this information throughout his hospital stay. And then when he's out, he's going to have to figure out what to do with it. And that's a lot to take in, because he's in the hospital for quite some time. And it feels that way when you're reading the book. It's like, oh, okay. All right. Still in the hospital. Still in the hospital.
Yep.
Okay.
Still going to physical therapy, I guess. See, and for me, that point ended at the very end of it, when Lee is kind of taken in and allowed to narrate it, you know, with that scene where she's almost dies and the hitchhiker and all of that. It feels like we get to have a little more development from Lee. But I think that that would have been more impactful if that wasn't the only real instance we have with her, because otherwise she just feels kind of like a bit player, which doesn't really work when you're telling this incredibly important detail of Lee almost dying the way that LeBay's daughter died. And it has such a big part to the story, because it's where Arnie really is lost. Like, there isn't much Arnie left,
right,
that can, at least that we can see. And I think that's supposed to be kind of the pivotal moment where Lee realizes, like, nope, this is over. This is over. I am not getting back in your car. I am not. We are not dating unless you get rid of that thing, because this is not going to work for me. Your car is literally trying to murder me. No, thank you. And Arnie just kind of lets it all happen. He's like,
yeah.
Oh, I thought I could pat you on the back. Like, no, dude, come on.
Exactly. I think that leads us right into the pacing of the story pretty nicely, because we're pretty much in agreement that we like this story, but it was a little too long. And, you know, over 500 pages made this story feel like it probably could have been cut down by, I want to say, like, maybe 100 pages, to be honest, because in those moments where Dennis is in the hospital, we're not getting a ton of Dennis. It's like, you know, here's an update on Dennis. Here's what happens when someone comes to visit him. And I thought that was fine, but just the amount of time that we spend on Arnie getting worse and worse, even though it's very clear that's what's happening, it just sort of hit a lull for me when I was reading this. And this book actually took me a lot longer than usual to read, mostly because of time constraints on my part, and because at times I was just like, this is starting to feel like a chore to read.
Oh no, that's the worst. But I feel the same way. I felt the same way. There were a couple days, because usually I listen to these while I'm at work or on my way home or whatever, where I was like, you know, I think I just need to listen to some My Brother and Me or something right now instead of this. And there was a point where it gets so dark. I felt like that was another thing I wanted to make sure I brought up, was how this kind of felt like it was hearkening back to King's, you know, his really dark days, and, well, like the Bachman books or something like that, where it goes to some real nasty places. And Christine felt like almost a throwback to that. So at times I was just like, this is too much right now. You're just too angry, and I just can't with this.
Yeah, I know what you mean. And I think part of that has to do with the car feeling so one-dimensional too. It's like, okay, all right, we get it. You know, Christine doesn't like anyone, even though cars cannot like or dislike people.
Yes, exactly. It felt like it was hitting the same message over and over again. And that was, you know, once or twice is okay. And I know the rule of threes and all, but you can hit those throughout the book. It doesn't have to hit every, because there's like three sections to this one, I think, is what it is, and an epilogue. And it felt like it was hitting that over and over again in each section. And it needed a little chopping. Like, it wouldn't be a whole 100 pages just out of anywhere. It would be slimming it down, where it's like, okay, you've already said this. we're repeating ourselves now. Let's move on or just add half this information or something, because it just feels like it drags at certain points.
Yeah. Do you have anything else you want to touch on before we dive into the ending?
Oh, no, let's get to it. That part was, that was the payoff after all of that time. And I'm just, I want to know how you felt about it. So you go first.
It's one of those things where I really liked how the book ended before the epilogue. And parts of the epilogue work for me. You know, the news story about the accident in Los Angeles. I think we could have done without some of the updates on, you know, what ended up happening with Dennis and Lee, because with Arnie and Christine always being sort of in the back of their minds, I never felt like those two were going to get a happily ever after with each other. So I don't think I necessarily needed all of that information in the epilogue. And, you know, it, I think what he could have done was ended it the way he ended it and then just have the epilogue be like a newspaper clipping of the accident or something, because as you and I both know, he's done that before where he's put letters in and newspaper clippings and things to that effect in his stories to sort of bolster that outsider perspective. And I think leaving us with something like that would have been a little more effective, but I do like that they at least put that accident in there.
Yeah, I agree. We didn't, I mean, as much as I, it felt weird that it was 4 years later.
Yeah.
And there was all of this development. I was like, 4 years, man, what are you talking about? This should be like a 10-year, like you're still writing Christmas cards and acting like it's, you know, oh, it's been decades. And then I read, oh, 4 years, like what the hell? And she's got two kids? Like that's,
that was fast.
That's a lot though. Right? So you guys made it 3 months is what I'm hearing here. And, you know, that just all felt like a little much. And I agree. It would have been, that ending would have been better with just a, or I think I would have found it more satisfying, we'll say, if there'd just been like a newspaper clipping about that accident or like a letter from him to her. Like, did you hear about this accident or something like that? And then you could have had all that information kind of hinted at without actually going into that great detail that kind of made it feel cheap.
And that right there would have cut out a few of those 100 pages or so.
Right. Yeah, it would have helped. But the, I don't know, when I drove home listening to this ending, I missed my exit because I was so into it. And I was like, oh, I'm not going to turn around. Yeah, because it was just like, it is nail biting ending when they're all trapped in that garage and trying to figure out what's going on with Christine and all of that. Like, I really enjoyed, or at least it was satisfying for me, the that final confrontation. But oh God, was it painful at points, because they're just, they make all of the stupidest choices, which is how it's supposed to be. But still, it's aggravating when they make all the stupid choices.
I would say from the time that Dennis went home and Lee paid him a visit at home until that moment before the epilogue, that was some of the fastest parts of the book for me. It was like, I did not want to put the book down for that chunk of it. I probably had to at some point, but I feel like that's, that portion of the book at the end there went by so much faster than pretty much any other part of it. I don't know if it's just because I happen to have been able to make more time to sit down and read it in a bigger chunk or what, but it was one of those things where I was like, oh, you know, maybe I'll finish this tomorrow. But then I just ended up reading the final 60 or 70 pages that night instead.
Yeah, it had a lot of payoff for a lot of buildup. And, you know, it is a really dark ending. And until you get to the epilogue anyway, then it kind of muddles that. But it is crushingly painful to read or listen or whatever through that scene in the garage, because it is so tense. It is so tense. All the waiting that they have to do and all of the pain that Dennis is in while he's dealing with his essentially refractured leg. Like, oh, and just want to scream sometimes, like, no, don't do it, you know. And that to me is the sign of a good ending, when I'm that fully engaged in the story. And so I think he pulls the ending off, even if the rest of it is a little bumpy, we'll say. It's a bumpy road for Christine.
All the pun intended.
Yes, all of them. All of the pun.
I just have a couple final thoughts before we wrap this up, but all of these kids are in high school, and at times it feels like the parents are doing everything they can to remind you of that, you know, college applications. And as you and I probably know, that is a big part of your senior year of high school. And even when Buddy Ruperton and his gang of Mary characters, so to speak, were present in the story, it never really felt like much of a high school story. And I think there's almost a way that could have been played at a little more in this, because you have these high school kids sort of just going around doing whatever they want. And while maybe that's something that is perfectly plausible in the 80s, it's kind of like, but you still have to go to school at some point. And we do get a few of those moments, but I think maybe when Dennis was in the hospital, if we went back to the high school a couple more times, it might have felt not as rote as it did, because it's like, okay, we get it, he's with Christine, but how about we change the setting up a little here while Dennis is in the hospital and see what happens?
Right, and see how Arnie is dealing with his life now that, you know, it's completely changed. And I think at least part of that is the fact that this was actually set 1978 and 1979. And at that time,
okay, yeah,
I believe the drinking age was 18 everywhere. And so they're drinking beer with their parents, first of all. And then there's a fucking smoking area at the school. And those two things are just so far away from anything that, you know, I can imagine in my high school career, where my dad's like, hey, go grab a couple beers, you know. Yeah. Like that to me, even in my senior year in high school, like that's a strange concept. And smoking at school and not getting yelled at by the teachers is like, well, that doesn't happen. So at times I agree, it totally felt like they were more college kids than high school kids. But I think that that's partially because of the era in which it's talking about, is that, you know, 17 was pretty much an adult at that time.
I think there were just some things that felt like they had some holes in them. It's like, you know, Dennis was on the football team, and yet we only hear about the coach a couple times when Dennis is in the hospital. It's like, what about all those people? How are they feeling about Dennis being in the hospital? It was something I kind of wondered, even though they weren't meant to be real parts of the story in any way. I think just sort of taking us out of Arnie's world for a little bit would have been nice, because you have all of these things happening with Dennis and Lee, and it's like, okay, what about, you know, what's going on with them? We get the parents, but we don't get anything else really out of those characters. And I think that would have made things a little more well-rounded, I guess you could say.
Right. Like, well, how are these people reacting to the fact that there are all these car deaths? People are just being brutally murdered by a car, a random car that no one can find. Like, that's a pretty crazy thing to be happening. And it kind of gives the impression that this is a fairly small, centrally located town. So it feels like you said, a couple of like almost crowd reaction shots of Buddy Ruperton or even the coach, how the coach handles it afterwards, or rando kid at school. King does really well when he has those little vignettes from rando person in the area to give that perspective. And I think, well, it might have added a little length to the story while we're chopping. It wouldn't have felt like such a small story that's trying to be so big.
In a way, it almost accomplishes that when Junkins comes into the picture. He's the one investigating everything, and I think he sort of brings this different perspective. But because Arnie is so stubborn and Junkins knows he's hiding something, it sort of just becomes this runaround until they catch Arnie with the cigarettes that he's smuggling. And even then, it's like nothing really comes of that. And then next thing you know, Junkins is dead. And you have so much there that I think something like that with people from the town would have been nice to see, because obviously this is Junkin's job. He has to worry about this. But with the town, it's like, you know, are they handing out a curfew for kids so that they're not getting run down at night? Because Christine isn't really doing any of this stuff in the middle of the day, if I'm not mistaken.
Right. It all happens at night. And or like they aren't pulling over more red cars because they found red paint. So red car, they're not randomly searching red cars or something like that. Yeah. It felt like these big events are happening, but it's all in this microcosm where everybody else only kind of peripherally knows about it, even though it's mentioned like that these things are in the paper and that people are talking about them. But we never really see that happening. It's just paid lip service to, and then we move on.
Exactly. Well, is there anything else that you want to hit on before we wrap this up?
I do have to say that this was better than I expected. Like, obviously we've talked about it pretty extensively now, and there's good parts and bad parts, but I honestly expected this to just be terrible because, you know, I've seen Maximum Overdrive, and that's kind of what I expected, was something a little more mindless. But it actually had some really interesting parts to it, and if you've been holding off on reading it because it looked just totally mind-numbing, or just one of King's lesser works, I would say it's still worth reading. Just don't expect it to be, you know, The Stand or It or something like that.
Exactly. And Stephen King seems to really enjoy some stories about cars, because not only does he have Christine, I'm glad you mentioned Maximum Overdrive because that was his film that he directed. And then you have From a Buick 8. So, you know, you have a few things going on in the Stephen King universe here that involve cars. And, you know, these, I don't know what Maximum Overdrive is like because I have yet to watch it. I'll be getting to it. But, you know, Christine and From a Buick 8, those involve very, very large cars. And they just sort of have this presence about them. It's like, you know, boat cars are huge. That's why they call them boat cars.
Right. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, Maximum Overdrive is its own crazy beast, honestly. I've watched it, and I kind of remember watching it like, what is going on right now throughout the entire thing? Because it's just so bizarre. It is bizarre. Like, I think it's fun, but it's not a good movie. We'll say that.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to not only watch the adaptation of this, but Maximum Overdrive as well. And I am definitely looking forward to it. And I agree with you. I did like the story overall, but I think you can like something and also point out its flaws at the same time. I feel like I probably wouldn't have a couple podcasts at the moment if that was something I was not able to do.
Right. Right. That's the best part. That's why you read stuff and watch stuff and consume stuff, is to think about it. And discussing the flaws is so important. And it helps people make better stuff, and it helps you think more critically about things, which is always the best way to consume your media, is critically.
Absolutely. And Katie, thank you so much for coming on to talk about this. I know this was one of the holes in the schedule, and I was like, all right, who will talk about Christine with me?
Oh, I'll talk about any Stephen King, you know.
I greatly appreciate that. And to our listeners, you can follow us at Chat Cemetery on Twitter and Instagram. You can subscribe to this podcast wherever you are listening to it right now. And as always, thank you all for listening, and we hope you enjoy the rest of your day.
Thank you.